You're listening to the Study Legal English podcast, helping lawyers and law students become fluent in legal English. For more information, visit studylegalenglish.com. Hello, and welcome to episode 81 of the Study Legal English podcast. I'm your host, Louise, and today I've got a very special guest on the show. But before I get started, I just want to say that this episode is sponsored by iTalki, the platform where you can find lots of language teachers online and take classes from wherever you are in the world. It's super simple to use. You just register, then you can browse through lots of different teachers. Once you've registered and you've chosen your teacher, you can easily see the teacher's availability and then schedule the class to fit your needs. Once you've done this, you connect using Skype or another video chat software such as Google Hangouts, and there you go, you start learning straight away. So it's super convenient, really easy to use, and a really, really effective way to learn English. So if you're curious to try this out, you can get $10 worth of free iTalki credits when you purchase your first class. Just go to go.italki.com/study-legal-english. I will, of course, leave the link in the show notes. Great. So in today's show, I interview none other than Stephen Horowitz. He's the Director of Legal English Programs at St. John's Law, a university based in Queens, New York, in the United States. I first heard about Stephen because he's an avid writer on one of the Legal English blogs I follow, the St. John's Legal English blog. This is a blog I really recommend for legal English teachers because it's got some very helpful articles about lessons and teaching strategies, but it has also got some useful articles for learners too. The link is stjohnslegalenglish.com. That's all one word, by the way. Now, something interesting about St. John's Law is that the school runs a number of specialised LLMs for non-native English-speaking law students. For example, there are courses called Transnational Legal Practice or English for American Law School. Now, before I carried out the interview with Stephen, we Skyped because we both thought it would be a good idea to meet online and have a chat to get to know each other before the interview. We both said we'd be about 30 minutes for the call, and an hour later we were still deep in conversation. Why? Because Stephen has a great passion for legal English, a thoroughly interesting background, and many, many skills. Of course, we had lots to talk about then in our first Skype call, as well as when we did the interview a few weeks later. So in this interview, I talked to Stephen about legal writing, about studying an LLM as a foreign student, and ways that you can improve your legal English. Sadly, I didn't go all the way to New York to do the interview, although that would have been very nice. Instead, I carried out the interview on Skype, and you can access the interview as a video too if you head over to the Study Legal English YouTube channel or by visiting studylegalenglish.com/episode-81. So, happy listening, and let's get started. Hi, Stephen.
Hi, Louise. Thank you so much for having me on this show. I've never been on a podcast before, though I love listening to them all the time.
Good. Thank you. Good. So we decided to focus the interview today on legal writing. But before we get into that, Stephen, can you talk a little bit about how you got to where you are today, how you ended up at St. John's Law?
Yeah, I guess first I'll talk about where I am right now. To sort of give context to sort of my indirect path here. St. John's Law School is in Queens, New York, which is apparently the most linguistically diverse place, not just in part of New York, but in the world. Because there's so many cultures here, Queens is known for having all these different people from all around the world coming and living here. And St. John's Law School has been a fantastic place to be a legal English person, as it turned out, although I didn't know that when I got here, and I don't know if they knew that either, but they've been extremely committed to LLM students, and they've been extremely supportive of me and my colleagues as we try to develop and do things to support LLM students with legal English. We've got a team of, we've got 13 people who focus on LLM students here, which I think is very unique among American law schools. And six of us have are not just lawyers, but also have ESL teaching experience here. So that's kind of a unique thing as well. And it's been a really great opportunity to work inside of a law school as an ESL person, but also a lawyer. So let's see. So my path here, after college, I was thinking about law school, but I went off to Japan on something called the JET program, the Japan Exchange Teaching Program, which is a program where the Japanese government brings in several thousand native English speakers and people from other countries to work in the school system as sort of to teach language, but it's also intended as grassroots diplomacy. So I was plopped down in a school system in Japan and I stayed there for a couple of years. And then when I came back, while I was there, I applied to law school and ended up going to Duke Law School right after coming back. Although while I was at Duke, I escaped back to Japan a couple times to work for some lawyers and to study a little bankruptcy law at a university. And then I went on to practice law for a short while. Kind of realized at a big firm in New York was not my ideal situation, we should say.
Yes.
And then I still worked in law, but I worked with a company that was working on bankruptcy cases, doing shareholder and creditor communications. I stayed involved with the JET Alumni Association, became very active with that, and was always thinking about how do I sort of keep this connection with the global community. Which wasn't happening in my work and in my career. And I was doing some grant writing for a nonprofit at one point as I tried to move farther away from the law and finally decided I wanted to get back into ESL teaching. And that's where I'm always happiest and felt like I could really help people. So I did a CELTA. After that, I realized that it made sense to do a master's in TESOL, which I did. I did that at Hunter College, which is part of the City University of New York system. I did it because it was the least expensive option. Mm-hmm. I already had a kid at that point, and I had to go at nights. But it turned out to be a fantastic program because of my professor Ann Ettinger, who I had for advanced grammar, who really opened my eyes to what grammar had become or is corpus linguistics and descriptivist approaches and things like that I was just completely unaware of before. Mm-hmm. So I started, I wanted to combine law and ESL to see if there was a way to do that. And so I started calling around to different law schools, talking to different people, trying to get the lay of the land and figure out what the needs were at law schools. Somebody I knew at St. John's, I reached out to, and they I think they had just started up an LLM program, so it was kind of the right place at the right time. The way I remember it is I went in thinking I was just going to talk with them, and by the time I left, I felt like they had sort of strapped me down to the chair and told me I couldn't leave until I started working.
You must have made a good impression.
Yeah, and they needed somebody with my specific skills, but it turned out to be a great fit. And I really, I didn't know what to expect. I didn't know a lot about St. John's, other than it was out in Queens, and they historically had a great basketball team. Mm-hmm. But it's turned out to be a really wonderful culture here. Yeah. Really, very friendly, very supportive, very easy to. It's not a huge law school, so it's been a really nice place. You can get to know everybody, and that's been great because I've been able to facilitate a lot of collaborations. I can take my students into a professor's class. I can, what do we do? I like to get conversation partners from the American students to match them with our LLM students and other things that really allow us to help the LLMs integrate into the law school community, which can be a very intense community, but it's great to meet. And it's also great for the JD students, the American JD students, to get to interact with the LLM students. I remember when I studied law in Japan, I had a very isolated experience. And it would have, you know, it makes a big difference when you have people who can help you, who can help you integrate. And I think another feature of my colleagues that, that I really appreciate is they've lived abroad as well. So they know what it's like. Yes. They've got the same background. And I think that's something that drives me and drives them. You want, people were very kind to you when you, when you lived abroad. They were very kind to me, and you appreciate it. You want it, you want to pay that forward. You want to return the favor and help them have a good experience.
Yes.
In the US, especially in light of current politics and trends, you know, anything we can do to help people have a positive experience here when they're coming from another country, I think is extremely valuable and needed.
Now, I mentioned in the introduction a little bit about the LLM courses at St. John's Law. Can you explain a little bit more about them?
Oh, okay. So let me, I'll put it in perspective a little bit. We've got two LLM program tracks. One is TLP, Transnational Legal Practice, at St. John's Law School. The other is USLS, US Legal Studies. The TLP is focused, the TLP program is focused on cross-border transactions, cross-border practice. It's for students who are not planning to stay in the U.S. for their careers. They're planning to eventually return to their home country, but they want to be able to function well in a global legal marketplace, be able to interact well with American lawyers, with other lawyers in English, and have the lay of the land and know what they're doing and know what they're talking about. The USLS program is focused, is primarily focused on students who are planning to practice law in the US. A lot of the students, but not all of the students in that program, are immigrants from other countries who were lawyers or law grads from their own country, and now they're living here and they want to be able to practice law. So it's also very bar exam focused. The goal is to help these students pass the bar. And that's something that we provide a lot of support for our LLM students for.
St. John's has got a very high pass rate for the bar exam.
We have a overall we have a very high pass rate. But what's not in those statistics is the pass rate for LLM students. For our school or for any school, those are generally not available. And we've done a lot to really improve the pass rates for LLM students. I think there's a lot we do in terms of language support, in terms of study support, in terms of just general support, feeding the students during bar study, during this very intense period of studying for the exams, to help them. And I think we've done a good job of helping LLM students pass the bar.
And the law courses that you mentioned, are they only attended by students who have finished, I don't know, that younger students who've just finished their courses in their own countries? Or are they also attended by more mature students? I don't know, lawyers who are actually working in the field?
It's a mix. It's students coming out of universities, out of law programs in their own countries, but it's also lawyers from other countries who want to come and study U.S. law and be prepared to function well in a global legal marketplace. And then the other piece of it is to prepare the students for these two tracks. For one of these two tracks, we have a 4-week summer course called English for American Law School. And this is very, I think this is very common at a lot of law schools to have a summer program like this. In those 4 weeks, with myself and two other professors, we review the fundamentals of the U.S. legal system. We work on the fundamentals of legal writing. We work on the fundamentals of reading and briefing cases and reading strategies in law school, and really try to prepare the students for how different the studying and the expectations are in American law school. And this is something that not just for LLMs, but JD students, the American law students who come out of college and go to law school, law school in the US is a very different study culture than undergraduate studying. So it's something we really try to prepare them for. We also take them, we do some a lot of fun things. We're going to take them on some field trips. I set up for this summer, I just arranged a field trip where in the morning we're going to go to the Supreme Court in Manhattan. Sorry, the Supreme in New York means the trial court. It's not the Supreme Court in New York.
Okay.
The court system is kind of unique in that way. Yeah. So in the morning, we're going to go to the court and get a tour of the court. In the afternoon, we're going to go to New York's city council to see the legislative branch. And then after that, we may also be able to go to we're hopefully going to be able to go to the mayor's office, which is right next door. So we'll get all three branches of government
Very
in one
nice.
Day.
Good.
It should be fun.
Yeah. Because, I don't know about you, but I found my law studies quite dry. So anything that can make it a bit more interesting certainly helps.
Yeah, and in terms of engagement and motivation to study, that can be really helpful. And also in terms of building background knowledge and cultural knowledge, I think it's a term that sort of gets thrown around, but it's a huge component of reading comprehension. Background knowledge and cultural knowledge. So anything we can do to add flesh to the bones, to the skeleton of law that we teach in class, and give students concrete examples and really give them the background that they need, because so much of studying in law school and legal English is so much of it is background knowledge. You can know all the words, all the grammar, you can even know the law, but when you read a case about something about a train company, mm-hmm. or you read a case about a football game or something, if you don't know about that, it can be very hard to follow along with the reading. So studying law in the U.S., and I assume everywhere, requires a lot of cultural and background knowledge as well. Mm-mm.
So you mentioned that legal writing is a really important element of the LLM for non-native English-speaking law students. Why is legal writing so important?
That's a good question and a big question. Let's see. Mm-hmm. One reason is a sort of simple reason is that in law, I think more so than any other field or discipline, words are power. Mm. So having control of the words and using accurate words is really important. Another reason is that in law school in the U.S., writing is how you demonstrate, and I assume in most academic settings, writing is how you demonstrate your knowledge. Mm. You want to get good grades in law school. If you want to pass the bar exam, you need to be able to write well. Additionally, in law school and in legal culture, there's specific forms of writing. And the most common one that people like to talk about and teach is IRAC, IRAC. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Rule, application, conclusion. And this is the primary sort of form of writing that is taught in law school and that students need to learn to master. And I should mention there's variations on IRAC. There's CRAC, which is conclusion, rule, application, conclusion, or other forms that are used depending on the genre and the context and a professor's preference or a judge's preference.
Yes. Could you explain IRAC a little bit more? Because we spoke briefly about this when we first met on Skype a couple of weeks ago, and I had never heard of it before because, unfortunately, on my law course, we didn't exactly study legal writing. So I was unfamiliar with the term. Could you explain it a little bit more?
Yes. Good question. Yes. And I'm so used to talking about it that it's easy to forget that, I'm in my own world, my own bubble when I talk about these things. In law school in the US, they didn't used to teach legal writing. And in the last, 30 years, legal writing has become a very big component of the law school curriculum. IRAC is issue, rule, application, conclusion. And that means when you get typically you get a fact pattern. Mm-hmm. Something happens to somebody. Usually it's bad. Something bad happens to somebody and they've got problems. And as the lawyer or as the judge, it's your job to figure out first, what is the legal issue, right? Mm-hmm. Learn it's not always about the answer. It's about asking the right question. So you have to figure out what is the issue. Then you figure out what is the rule. The rule can be a statute. The rule can be case law. The rule can be a combination of all those things. In U.S. law, in U.S. law schools, a lot of it is about common law and case law. So figuring out how to find the rule and extract the rule and synthesize the rule is its own challenge in the rule section. And then in the application or analysis section, you're taking the rule and applying the facts to it to get to reach your conclusion. And then you reach the conclusion at the end. And this is it's a style that's very unique to law school, but it's not, it has a certain universality as well. I know of one law professor who likes to use Martin Luther King's letter from a Birmingham jail with his first year law students and they analyze it and deconstruct it to see that that letter actually follows essentially an IRAC discourse.
And so what are the common problems that students face when they are doing legal writing?
Let's see. One of the biggest challenges of good writing is actually good reading because law school writing, like many other forms of writing, is a reaction to reading. So if you don't comprehend well what you've read or what's happening, it's going to be hard to write well on it. And so one of the things that underlies my approach and the approach that we try to take here is that is when we're working on legal writing, we want to use texts that the students are comprehending well, or if they're more difficult, we spend a lot of time scaffolding the comprehension, because otherwise, if they don't write well on it, then we're not evaluating their writing, we're evaluating their reading. So also in line with this, we focus a lot on reading strategies, on strategies to build reading speed, because there's so much reading to do in law school, and because on exams, the questions are usually fact patterns that are very long. So LLM students often, what they find challenging is they don't have enough time, or they don't have as much time to write because they're spending more time reading. So reading is a huge component to writing well. So that's one challenge. Mm-hmm. One student was talking to me as he was preparing for the bar. He said, I'm doing well on, what was it? On evidence questions or something, but with tort and criminal law questions, there's always some fact or some nuance that I miss. And then I get the question wrong because of some sort of cultural knowledge, something he missed, some twist in the phrasing or the language. Another challenge is a lot of students come from academic writing cultures that are reader responsible as opposed to writer responsible. And what that means is that at least in U.S. academic writing culture, we expect more explicitness. Mm-hmm. It's the writer's job to make sure that the reader understands. Whereas in other cultures, it's the reader's job to infer meaning. And this point was driven home to me one point when one of my students said, if I wrote like you want me to write, if I wrote like that back in my country, my professor would be insulted. And that really drove home to me the point of how it's almost a form of code switching. We have to teach the students to code switch between it's not that their style is wrong or incorrect, but when you're writing in a U.S. law school and you're writing for a U.S. audience, you need to write in a certain way, and it has to be very explicit. It has to, and it feels very obvious. It feels like you're whacking somebody over the head with your points, but the underlying assumption of writing culture in law school here is that we want to make everything very explicit so it's easy to follow the trail. We want it to, transparency is the right word, but we want it to be very easy to follow. And there's sort of an assumption that as you're reading, you might forget things. So you want to make it super easy for everybody to understand. So there's no possible way that something could be misunderstood. And the bar for where that misunderstanding or that is very different than it might be in their home country. And then I think another component of it is also that it's hard to learn how to write in another culture style, yeah. because I think there's an asymmetry. I think there's an asymmetry in learning to write versus learning to read. The way you learn to read well is by reading a lot. The way you learn to write well is only partly by writing a lot. You could write a lot forever, but if you don't have feedback and you don't have models, you're not going to improve. And you'll keep doing whatever it is that you think is right without knowing sort of what is the appropriate way. And the asymmetry is that the kind of reading that we expect students to produce is not really the kind of, is not the same kind of text that they're actually reading. So they're reading newspaper articles, New York Times articles, they're reading legal textbooks. We don't expect them to produce legal textbook writing. We don't expect them to write, even the model answers, say, in the bar preparation materials from the private bar companies. The students don't need to write like that. They don't need to write answers as thorough and complete and use that language. What they need to be able to write is the way that an average student in law school writes. And so I think it's really important to create a lot of model answers, as partly so you can deconstruct and notice the discourse patterns, the language in them, but also because it can be its own form of extensive reading, where if you can read a lot of model answers of the kind that you're supposed to produce, you will start to develop a sense and an ear of what sounds right, of what's expected. You'll start to internalize that. And I think that's really hard. We, a lot of times in classes, LLM students are expected to write a certain way, and they have not had that much exposure to that writing, maybe a model answer or two. And I think it helps to have a lot more.
Yeah, and sometimes sometimes the stuff that you're reading, like if it's very complex and badly written, I mean, it could have a detrimental effect on the writing ability, because if students mimic that very, kind of a lots of use of the passive voice or things like that, it's not necessarily good writing. Choosing the text that they read must be quite a challenge.
Yes, and it's hard to find. I mean, people, there aren't books of model answers of average, you know, student. I mean, that's not something that's generally available.
One for you to write.
Well, I'm sort of working on it. I mean, I have this one fact pattern that I always use with my students about a jogger and a banana peel. It's a very simple fact pattern. It moves any issues of comprehension. And I've created now, I think, 25 model answers. It's also very easy to write a model answer. So I've written a few model answers. I've had colleagues write model answers. I'm constantly getting more American law students to write model answers. Some are good. Some are not as good. But there's all these examples that students can read, and it becomes its own form. So it is kind of a book.
Are there any other resources or tools or methods that you use to develop the student's ability to recognize what sounds right, to develop that skill within students?
Another thing I do is I encourage the students to read the model answers out loud, and specifically focus on things like articles, prepositions, and other connecting words and phrases, because something like articles. Students, it's very difficult to learn how to use articles properly in English if you're not a native speaker. And we don't learn the rules for them. The rules for them are ridiculously complicated and extensive. I've even had one of my linguistics professors said, there's no point in trying to teach articles. But the way we learn it is by ear. So one thing that's helpful is reading model answers out loud and noticing and making sure to notice the small words, the articles, the prepositions, and the connecting words. Prepositions also, very arbitrary and very different from language to language. Learning what sounds right and develop that your sense by reading yourself, by reading out loud. On top of that, I'll often record myself or a colleague reading those same model answers so that students can listen to them. Because the other piece of those articles and prepositions is that they get dropped in speech. Mm. So it's harder to hear them if you're not used to hearing them. So the other thing that can be helpful is training your ear. So after you've read them out loud and you've started to hear yourself say them and know when to expect them, then if you listen to model answers being read out loud by a native speaker, you try to hear the very soft, subtle the or to or of. And that starts to build up the sounds and how these words are actually groups of words. They're, you know, it's not just individual words, but you start to hear groups of words and your brain starts to anticipate that. So those are some techniques that can be very helpful for getting past certain language issues in writing. Mm-hmm.
So when we spoke on Skype previously, you mentioned something which I can't quite recall, but it was something to do with the SATs, using the SATs to teach something which I think was categorization and...
Right. So I started using SATs are the standardized tests that all high school students in the U.S. take as part of their college application process. Mm-hmm. There's a section on it called analogies, and it'll have three words in a blank, and it'll say A is to B as C is to blank, and then you've got a choice of four or five words. So I decided that this is good since analogical reasoning is a very important part of the law school curriculum, since you have to analogize cases to facts and fact patterns. Mm-hmm. I realized that analogies are a great way to work. These short analogy problems or questions are a great way to work on that and remove the comprehension piece. It's just four words, right? And then you've got a few more words. It's good for building vocabulary too. But then on top of that, I started getting students to try to explain the sentence. Why is that the correct answer? Why is that not the correct answer? And what that forces students to do is to think about classification or categorization words. For example, if you this is important because in legal writing, you might be writing about a statute, a communication statute, and say it has email, and that covers emails, faxes, texts, messengers. Instagrams or something like that. Mm-hmm. In your next sentence, you might use a determiner plus a classification word to say these forms of communication are, and then you'll say something about it. You need the correct classification word in that situation. If you have one, I tell my students it's like a jacket. If it's too big, if it's too broad or general, it doesn't fit right, right? And that can leave you open to liability or can leave your argument open. Mm-hmm. If you use them, it's too tight. If it's too narrow, it leaves things out. That's also not accurate. Mm-hmm. So knowing a word, this goes back to my advanced grammar professor, Ann Ettinger, would always talk about what is it to know a word? Well, you have to know the definition and the meaning of a word, but it also, there's a lot of other knowledge about words. And some of that knowledge is knowing classification words that relate to that word when you go a level up. And analogies and writing, and then so starting with analogies and then writing out sentences and having to use classification words, I found to be very helpful for students in their building their vocabulary for the purposes of legal writing.
So yeah, it's a really helpful skill to be able to categorize things as a lawyer, because it's something that you can use if you go on to write contracts, if you go on to draft legislation, or even just to be able to understand them. It's difficult to think of an example off the top of my head, but if you were drafting a piece of legislation, for example, which said this tax applies to apples, pears, and bananas, obviously that's very different to if you said this tariff applies to apples, pears, and other perishable goods. Each one of those, each sentence that I've just mentioned, has a very different interpretation because of that categorization.
I mean, I was remembering there's a fact pattern we use with our students that revolves around tariffs but it revolves around what is a toy and what's a doll. Uh-huh. And what falls in and out of that category, and being able to analogize and use classification words is really important to address that kind of distinction.
Yes.
Which can cost a client, you know, save a client a lot of money or cost a client a lot of money.
Yeah.
I should mention that the idea for the analogies came from a really terrific article, Cohesion, and in legal writing for LLM students by Professor Elizabeth Baldwin at the University of Washington Law School. And she is a legal writing professor, but also has a degree in applied linguistics. And she's written a number of really interesting things on the topic. But that Cohesion article is a really fantastic article and a great primer on the idea of cohesion in writing, because that's cohesion is that missing je ne sais quoi.
Yeah.
You know, you go, oh wait, this isn't quite working. I can't put my finger on why. And that article helps you put your finger on why.
Very good. So hopefully she explains it far better than I tried to.
Yes. And better than I could also.
good. So are there any other resources that you recommend for legal English learners?
Yes. One is something called the iWeb Corpus. The iWeb, a corpus in linguistics, a corpus is a big giant database full of texts. And the texts can be newspaper, magazine articles, books, websites. They can be transcripts of TV shows, anything you can think of that can be put into writing. And people use these linguistic texts to do linguistics research, to figure out not what grammar should be, but what grammar is. How do we actually use grammar? Or how do we actually use language? And you can study, there's all kinds of research you can do. The iWeb corpus is created by people at BYU who had created a previous corpus, which was kind of the most accessible and free corpus you could use. And now they've improved on it sometime last year, and it's now a 14 billion word corpus.
Yeah, it's huge, huge.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so what's great about it now, for at least from my perspective, is when you look up a word or you look up a phrase, it gives you a lot of very helpful, very accessible information. So it's kind of like a super dictionary. Mm. And coming back to that concept from from Professor Ettinger about what it means to know a word. If you look up a word on this, you really get to know a word, because it not only gives you the meaning and synonyms and antonyms and things like that, it also gives you all the sentences from the corpus, from the database that use that word. So there's tons of sample sentences you can look at to really get a feel for it. It also gives you collocations and clusters, so you can see what word appears most frequently right before this word, what word appears most frequently right after this word, what three words appear most frequently right before this word, what three words appear most frequently right after this word. And so that can give you a sense of, am I using this word correctly? Mm. Am I using this phrase correctly? And all kinds of other great information. So I created a 15-minute sort of screencast video tutorial on how to use the iWeb corpus for my students. And I'm happy to share the link. Mm. As well.
Yes, yeah, that will be super, super helpful, because I've seen the video and it's super, super helpful. So absolutely would, I'm sure the listeners out there, if they want a useful resource, they should check out this iWeb corpus and also watch your video, because it could probably be a bit daunting if you go on the iWeb corpus and you don't know what you're doing.
Yeah.
You kind of need an instructional video to kind of guide you through how to use it. So certainly I think they will be very grateful to have that link. So that brings us to the end of the interview. Stephen, thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me. This is a lot of fun.
Great. And so I'm going to share that video, the link as well to the St. John's blog, stjohnslegalenglish.com. I'll leave that link as well in the show notes. I highly recommend you check both of those resources out. And Stephen, if listeners are interested in St. John's Law and the blog, are they okay to get in touch with you?
Yes, please feel free. I'm happy to talk about our law school. I love talking about legal English and teaching, so feel free to reach out to me. I'm always happy to chat, brainstorm, whatever.
And I have a question for you listeners. When do you use legal writing, and what do you find difficult about it? Send in your answers to louise@studylegalenglish.com. So thank you for listening, and see you next time.
Thanks for listening to the Study Legal English podcast. If you really want to get ahead, why not become a member and gain access to many learning resources? Visit studylegalenglish.com/pricing.